From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new film 13 Days about the Cuban Missile Crisis has us thinking about the history of the crisis. On today's Fresh Air, the secret documents from the crisis. We hear from Tom Blanton of the National Security Archive, who collected those documents in a book. Then we talk about the nuclear scare with Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador to the U.S. at the time of the crisis, and Sergei Khrushchev. His father was the Soviet premier during the crisis. And film critic Henry Sheen reviews 13 Days. Also, world music critic Milo Miles remembers Czech musician Milan Holovsa. He founded the band The Plastic People of the Universe after the Soviet invasion of his country. He died last week. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Paul Brown. Israeli and Palestinian peace negotiators predicted today very little chance they will reach agreement before President Clinton leaves office. Nevertheless, American officials are encouraged. A State Department spokesman said the fact that the two sides are talking at all is positive. The negotiators say they will meet again tomorrow, possibly with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and former Israeli Prime Minister Shimon Peres leading the teams. Florida Secretary of State Katherine Harris, the state's top elections official, today told members of the U.S. Civil Rights Commission she actually knows very little about the day-to-day operations of the Elections Division. From Tallahassee, NPR's Philip Davis has more.
When the commission, which is investigating alleged irregularities in the Florida election, asked Harris about policies and actions in the state Elections Division, Harris repeatedly said she didn't know or referred answers to Clay Roberts, the division director of elections. Harris also testified that she understood she had no authority to give direction to county election supervisors or to set standards, even though commission members read her state law that seemed to give her that authority. Commission Chairman Mary Frances Berry called Harris's description of her role laughable and said no one seemed to want to take responsibility for the Florida election mess. Harris's testimony wrapped up 2 days of hearings by the Civil Rights Commission, which hopes to issue a preliminary report on the Florida election by May. Philip Davis, NPR News, Tallahassee.
The NBC television network said today that it will reduce its workforce by up to 10% during the first 3 months of the year. It's one of several media companies to reduce its staff because of the slowing advertising market. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
NBC Chief Executive Robert Wright said in a memo to his staff that the network would cut its 5,600-person workforce by 5 to 10%. Some of the positions will be eliminated through attrition. Wright said the current economic climate had affected the company's business. He said NBC, which is owned by General Electric, had tried to cut expenses without laying people off, but now he said the company needs to move beyond belt tightening. Wright said the network hoped to cut costs further through technological advances. NBC is not the only media company hurt by the slowing advertising market. CNN, which is owned by Time Warner, is expected to announce major layoffs over the next few weeks, and Fox TV has implemented a hiring freeze. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
Hewlett-Packard Company co-founder William Hewlett died this morning at age 87. Along with David Packard, who died in 1996, Hewlett helped launch an electronics and technology revolution out of a California garage. The Dow Jones Industrial Average closed down today 84.2 points at 10,525. The Nasdaq Composite closed down 14 points at 2626. This is NPR News. A federal judge handed Microsoft a partial legal victory today. U.S. District Judge J. Frederick Motz dismissed 38 private antitrust suits accusing the software giant of overcharging customers for its Windows operating system. Motz said he dismissed most of the suits because the plaintiffs received their software already loaded into personal computers bought from PC manufacturers. Stock in the new company AOL Time Warner Incorporated traded for the first time today. It opened at just over $47 a share and closed slightly lower. NPR's Snigdha Prakash reports.
It took a year and a day to get here. And my, how the world has changed. Technology stocks have been hammered since the deal was announced last January, and the economy is flirting with a recession. advertising will make up 20% of the new company's revenues, it's harder to come by when the economy slows. And consumers aren't as eager to snap up the whole menu of expensive new internet, cable, and phone services that AOL Time Warner wants to sell them. Still, on the first day of business, the company's chief executive, Gerald Levin, assured investors that AOL Time Warner would meet the revenue and profit goals it set itself last year. That would be $40 billion in revenue and $11 billion in earnings before interest, taxes, depreciation, and amortization. Analysts aren't as sure. Snigdha Prakash, NPR News, Washington.
Philadelphia police have charged two young men with killing seven people in a crack house last month. The mass killing was one of Philadelphia's worst shootings in decades. Police say the victims died in what was called a nickel-and-dime drug-dealing dispute. I'm Paul Brown, NPR News, in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Kauffman Center for Entrepreneurial Leadership at the Kauffman Foundation, providing resources for entrepreneurs on the web at entreworld.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new movie 13 Days, starring Kevin Costner, dramatizes the Cuban Missile Crisis, the most frightening crisis of the Cold War. Film critic Henry Sheehan will review the movie later. First, we're going to hear about the secret history of the crisis. It began in October of 1962 when the CIA learned that the Soviet Union had secretly moved nuclear missiles into Cuba. President Kennedy and his aides first considered the possibility of airstrikes on the missile sites, but decided instead to begin a naval blockade of Cuba. We knew America and the Soviet Union came close to nuclear war that October, but we didn't realize how close until the early 90s when secret documents from the crisis, including letters by Kennedy, Khrushchev, and Castro, were made public. This was largely the result of a six-year-long Freedom of Information Act lawsuit filed by the National Security Archive. Tom Blanton, the director of the archive, collected the documents in a book that was published in 1992. I spoke with him then and asked, how close did we come to nuclear war?
The new documents on the Cuban Missile Crisis show that we were much, much closer to a nuclear exchange between the Soviet Union and the United States than even the decision makers at the time thought. And the key to this has been the revelations from the Soviet side that they had tactical nuclear warheads in Cuba, and that if the United States had invaded Cuba to take out the missile sites for the larger ballistic missiles, the local Soviet commanders would have used those tactical nukes. And as Robert McNamara, Kennedy's Secretary of Defense, said, what would have been the result? Well, the Americans would have responded in kind, and the end would have been utter disaster.
When you say the local Soviet commanders had...
In Cuba.
So it wasn't even Khrushchev's call, it was just local commanders'
exactly.
call.
Exactly. And I think that is the real point of what all these new documents have come to and what all the former officials on both sides have now realized, which is one of the reasons that it got so dangerous was because it was, in a sense, out of control. From the United States side, we interpreted everything that happened in Cuba as a direct line to the Kremlin. We had a very exaggerated notion of the centralized control on their side, so that if they shot down a reconnaissance plane, which they did at the height of the crisis in Washington, President Kennedy and his advisors thought that must have been ordered by the Kremlin. And from the Kremlin side, they thought that everything we did was ordered by Washington. So when the Strategic Air Command went on its second highest level of alert, I mean, the highest level is war, the Strategic Air Command general did it in an open channel. And the Soviets thought, oh, Kennedy must have ordered that. They're about to go to war. This is a classic case of why crisis management is such a myth, that we now find out things were spiraling out of control. And if there's one underlying psychological dynamic that brought the settlement about, I think it was the realization by both Khrushchev and Kennedy that they didn't have so much control as they had thought.
So had we invaded Cuba, we probably would have been under nuclear attack. How close did we come to invading Cuba? Is there new information about that in the recently declassified documents?
Well, there's a conflict between among the president's advisors in their ex post facto reconstruction of the crisis. Secretary McNamara and the National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy both say that President Kennedy would have cut a deal and stopped short of an invasion. But if you look at the military plans, the CIA plans, all the things that were really underway, and put yourself in the shoes of the Cubans or the Soviets, they foresaw an invasion coming long before the missiles actually got to Cuba. It's one of the reasons they put them there. And they were in a position where they had a lot of incentives to do some preemptive action. So we came very close in the sense that neither side was in control anymore, in the sense of centralized control, and that there were tactical newts on the ground. But I think that Bundy may have a point that both Khrushchev and Kennedy were very scared of any such final military action. But for the first few days of the crisis, a military invasion was what was the first item on pretty much most of the American advisors' list, including Bobby Kennedy's.
Who are the people in the administration that argued most forcefully for invading Cuba to get rid of the Soviet missiles?
Well, there's this wonderful story about how the Kennedy administration brought in some of the old wise men to advise them in this hour of crisis. One of those was Dean Acheson, who had been Secretary of State under Harry Truman and one of the architects of the whole containment policy against the Soviet Union. Supposedly, Acheson said at one of these high-level meetings of what was known as the XCOM, the Executive Committee of the National Security Council, just the closest top advisors, Acheson said, "Well, of course we got to take them out." And somebody asked him, "Well, Mr. Acheson, how would the Soviets respond to that?" And Acheson said, "Well, I suppose they'd have to take out our missiles in Turkey." And then the person said, "Well, what will we have to do in response to that?" He said, "Oh, well, to support our NATO alliance and back up our ally Turkey, we'd probably have to attack some of the Soviet missiles maybe in the Soviet Union." And the person said, "Well, what happens then?" And Acheson said, "Well, hopefully by then cooler heads would prevail." Which sort of made the bigger point that we all needed the cooler heads to prevail from the start as opposed to at the finish.
Is there a new understanding as a result of these documents of the Soviet motives for bringing missiles into Cuba in the first place?
I think those are some of the most extraordinary revelations, because as a result of a six-year-long Freedom of Information Act lawsuit, we at the National Security Archive finally forced the State Department in January of this year to release Khrushchev's own letters to Kennedy and Kennedy's responses. A few of those had been released previously, but the government was still withholding these on the grounds that it was sensitive foreign government information. A key advisor to our whole project, a professor at American University, Phil Brenner, had the idea of just going to the new Russian government and getting a little diplomatic note from them saying, "Hey, we wouldn't mind if those letters came out." And between that note and our lawsuit, State Department finally released. And now we have these extraordinary missives, some of them obviously personally written or dictated by Khrushchev, just because of the emotional content and the very personalized appeals that he makes. There's one really extraordinary one on October 26th to President Kennedy that has a really amazing plea from Khrushchev that puts very strongly the Soviet claim that they weren't taking the offensive by putting these missiles in Cuba. From their point of view, these missiles were defensive. They were simply a match for the fact that the U.S. had missiles in Turkey. Supposedly, at one point, Khrushchev was walking around in his garden at his dacha on the Black Sea and with some foreigner and pointed across the Black Sea to Turkey and said, "There are U.S. missiles over there right now pointing right at us, right at this garden." So, in a sense, one of their motives had to be giving the Americans a little taste of their own psychological medicine. But here's Khrushchev's words to Kennedy, and I think it's a remarkable statement, and you can read this fellow's personality, and I think that's the most amazing thing about these new releases. Here's what he said. This is in the middle of this letter on October 26. He said, "But Mr. President, do you really seriously think that Cuba could launch an offensive upon the United States and that even we, together with Cuba, could advance against you from Cuban territory? Do you really think so? How can that be? We do not understand. Surely there has not been any such new development military strategy that would lead one to believe that it is possible to advance that way. And I mean advance, not destroy. For those who destroy are barbarians, people who have lost their sanity. We are sane people. We do understand and assess the situation correctly. How could we then allow the wrong actions which you ascribe to us? Only lunatics or suicides, who themselves want to perish and before they die destroy the world, could do this. But we want to live, and by no means do we want to destroy your country. We want something quite different, to compete with your country in a peaceful endeavor.
How much do you trust those sentiments?
Clearly they're self-serving, because Khrushchev is attempting to persuade Kennedy not to, to back off of these harsh actions. Kennedy had announced a quarantine. He had accused the Soviet Union of outright deception, of lying directly to him. And in fact, Kennedy was correct. The Soviets had lied directly to the U.S. about the placement of these missiles in Cuba. And I think in a strange way, Castro said he had urged Khrushchev to put the missiles there not in secrecy, because if he did it openly, the U.S. would be faced with an open international parallel. You've got missiles in Turkey, we're going to put missiles in Cuba. But to do it in secret opened yourself up to exactly the accusation that Kennedy made, the bad faith. It was a major, if you will, a psychological blow for Kennedy to be able to make that accusation and have it stick.
Did you feel like you learned anything new about how frightened people in the Kennedy administration were about the possibility of nuclear war?
Very much so. There's an extraordinary quote from, for instance, Dean Rusk, who was the Secretary of State at the time when the U.S. had set up the quarantine line to keep the Soviet ships from steaming to Cuba with more missiles and supplies. Kennedy announced the quarantine. The Navy went out there. A bunch of Soviet freighters were on their way. And then the first ones stopped dead in the water. And Rusk is said to have said, "We were eyeball to eyeball, and I think the other fellow just blinked." There was this sense of crisis. McNamara said, one of the mornings of the crisis, I think it was the morning of October 28th, after the U-2 pilot had been shot down over Cuba, and the Americans interpreted that as an order from the Kremlin to escalate this thing. When McNamara woke up, he said he looked around and he was amazed because he was still alive.
My guest is Tom Blanton, director of the National Security Archive. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're talking about the Cuban Missile Crisis with Tom Blanton, the head of the National Security Archive. How do these newly released documents revise our understanding of how the missile crisis was ended?
Publicly, the story that we heard was Khrushchev backed down, he's pulling the missiles out, and Kennedy is saying, look, we've got no intention to invade Cuba as long as we can verify that there aren't these missiles there. What we now know from the documents and the interviews that these documents have generated with former officials is that Bobby Kennedy carried a secret message to the Soviets saying, look, really, we're willing to take the Jupiter missiles out of Turkey that you're so worried about, but we can't do it publicly because it undermines a NATO ally. But we can assure you that early next year, we'll go ahead and take them out because they're obsolete anyway. And so there was a classic secret diplomatic negotiation that the American public was never told about, but that was the underlying factor in Khrushchev, I think, being willing to accept a deal, back down, and lose face. Afterwards, Khrushchev wrote a long letter to Castro, which is a fascinating postmortem on just what Khrushchev thought had occurred. Castro felt sold out by Khrushchev because Khrushchev had backed down. Castro.
Well, also, didn't Khrushchev not bother to consult Castro before reaching this agreement?
Exactly. And Castro at one point sent a very hot-headed letter to Khrushchev when Castro thought the U.S. was about to invade in the middle of the crisis. And the text of the letter sounds almost like Castro is saying, use them or lose them.
Well, actually, let me quote from that. Castro wrote, if they actually carry out the brutal act of invading Cuba in violation of all international law and morality, that would be the moment to eliminate such danger forever through an act of clear, legitimate defense, however harsh and terrible the solution would be.
That's right. And there you see some of the problem about using the word defensive weapons, because Castro is saying if U.S. invades, that is, with conventional weapons, use the nuclear weapons, which would clearly be a major escalation. And yet, it's a good thing that the invasion didn't happen. It's a very good thing that those tactical nukes weren't used. And it's a very good thing the nuclear exchange didn't happen. But it wasn't skill in crisis management, and it wasn't brinksmanship, eyeball to eyeball. It was luck in many respects and a secret diplomatic deal.
But isn't the secret diplomatic deal part of the brinksmanship and skill?
No, because I think the lesson of brinksmanship is you can play chicken with the other guys. And in fact, we didn't play chicken with the other guys. In fact, we offered them a secret deal under the table and didn't tell the public about it so they could go back to their hardliners and say, look, we achieved something. In public, it looked like we were playing chicken.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of scholars and policymakers ever since have said the lesson of the missile crisis is be tough and be strong. And if you draw that kind of lesson, then what you need to do with your military policy is talk tough, have a lot more guns than the other guy, and go eyeball to eyeball with him, and he'll blink. In fact, that's not the real story of the missile crisis. The real story is find out a deal that the other guy would accept that would help him save face and give him some of what he wants and get out of the crisis through a diplomatic negotiation, not brinksmanship.
Something else that emerges from these formerly classified documents is that Kennedy didn't want a settlement that would compromise the United States' efforts to overthrow Castro.
That's the most remarkable, I think, of the brand new documents just released this year under this Freedom of Information lawsuit that we brought against State Department. And that is Kennedy's letters right at the time that Khrushchev backed down seemed to make an almost explicit pledge that the United States would no longer consider an invasion of Cuba. And what we see after October 28th, when Khrushchev backed down, is a watering down of that pledge, and now we have a lot of the internal documents about why. And we have some of these State Department documents and studies that say, look, let's put real strong conditions on any no-invasion pledge. Let's say we'll only pledge if we can get UN verification that there are no more missiles there. Well, of course, I think they knew that the Cubans would never allow such a thing. What a violation of national sovereignty, etc. So they put conditions on that they thought wouldn't be fulfilled, and that way, and some of these documents say explicitly, that way we keep the option open for doing whatever we need to do in the future about Castro. And ultimately, by November 20th, and that's the one of the other pieces of news out of these documents, that the crisis wasn't just 13 days. They called it 13 days because that allowed it to end right before the midterm congressional elections that year, and the Kennedys were nothing if they weren't political and very politically astute, so they declared the crisis over. In fact, though, tensions continued on well into November over the remaining Soviet bombers and other nuclear-capable items in Cuba, and it wasn't until November 20th that the crisis really ended. And the crisis ended without any firm, unconditioned pledge from the U.S. In essence, Khrushchev backed off. He got a highly conditioned pledge, which said verification and these other, and Cuba can't take aggressive action in the hemisphere. So Khrushchev didn't get nearly what he thought he was getting. The U.S. kept its options open to continue to go after Castro, which they did. But the Jupiters did ultimately come out of Turkey.
Now, this new book on the Cuban Missile Crisis includes letters between Kennedy and Khrushchev, between Khrushchev and Castro. And I just found myself amazed as I was reading these letters to think that in the middle of this crisis that could have easily led to nuclear war, that Kennedy and Khrushchev are writing letters to each other. I mean, and what, mailing them airmail?
Well, some of them came through teletype. Some of them came by cable. But one of the that's one of the most fun stories. I think the Soviet ambassador, Dobrynin, at one point said that it was the most remarkable sort of Stone Age communication because they would get their cable in code, translate it from code into Russian or English, call a messenger who would ride up on a bicycle to the Soviet embassy, give it to the messenger. The bicyclist would, you know, head down 16th Street to the White House, deliver the letter. That's this whole little episode and some of the, you know, 8-hour delays in getting letters through led to two things. One, when Khrushchev made his proposal to withdraw the missiles, he did it over the radio so there wouldn't be any delay. And second, they installed that what became known as the hotline.
Oh, I see. The hotline wasn't installed till afterwards.
Exactly. How dangerous to have an 8-hour lapse at a time in which you got anti-aircraft batteries shooting down planes and invasion forces massing and ships coming head-to-head in the Caribbean. And just what a notion that you could have these letters being slowly teletyped out and handed by bicycle messengers.
Absolutely.
To each side.
I know, and then you know, the hotline became such an important part of Cold War iconography.
Exactly.
In the 60s.
But it was a very smart thing. I mean, that you could have that kind of direct communication.
Do you question the government's motives for keeping these documents classified for so long?
I do question their motives in the sense that I think it was bureaucratic inertia, certainly, that keeps this stuff classified for 30 years. But it's also the precedent that is set. We argued that they should release this stuff because no other event of the Cold War shaped our whole nuclear policy and our interpretation of Soviet intentions more than the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, that really fed, I would argue, a lot of the Vietnam syndrome, the sense that you had to be tough with the Russians and they would back down. You had to go eyeball to eyeball, and I think that's sort of what we tried to do in Vietnam, and it was a failure. So I think we see the government's motivations in this as protecting their own ability to make the decisions without criticism and without input from outside. There's a bureaucratic tendency to sort of cover your rear and not have your mistakes exposed to the public. And the other excuse they gave was if they released this, they'd be violating the communications with a foreign government. Well, so it really helped when the Russian government said, hey, we should release this.
Well, Tom Blanton, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Tom Blanton recorded in 1992 after he edited a book collecting the secret documents of the Cuban Missile Crisis. He's the director of the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN, from BEA, providing the WebLogic e-business platform, infrastructure software for the development and deployment of e-business applications, BEA.com, and from Wilmington Trust, recognizing worth in individuals and in unique programs like Fresh Air. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the nuclear scare from the Russian point of view. We hear from Anatoly Dobrynin, the Soviet ambassador during the Cold War, and Sergei Khrushchev, son of the Soviet premier Nikita Khrushchev. Henry Sheehan reviews the new film 13 Days, and we remember Czech musician Milan Holovsa, leader of the band The Plastic People of the Universe. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The movie 13 Days, which dramatizes the Cuban Missile Crisis, opened nationally today. The crisis brought us to the brink of nuclear war. During most of the Cold War, from 1962 to 86, Anatoly Dobrynin was the Soviet ambassador to the U.S. From the Cuban Missile Crisis to the beginnings of perestroika, he was the primary link between Washington and Moscow. In 1995, I spoke with him about the nuclear scare. Did you ever feel like any of the American or Soviet presidents that you worked with were willing to use nuclear weapons?
No. Answer is 100% no, from both sides.
Mm-hmm.
Because I spent too many years in your country, and I know how that developed, so I didn't really believe that you're going to attack us suddenly with the nuclear weapons. As for our, I knew too perfectly well, because one thing, when I, first thing which was given instruction by, when I was appointed as ambassador, I was the youngest ambassador in the United States from our diplomatic service. Khrushchev invited me to the Kremlin, and he first thing he said, "Ambassador, your number one task is avoid by any cost any war, especially nuclear war, with the United States. This is number one task you always have to keep in mind." And all others, beginning our president or the chiefs, they always repeat me the same. So I knew that there was no any plans for immediate attack, etc. I knew from there, and I was sure about you. But it not was the case in our own government. I may put it this way. During the Reagan period, especially during the first period, there were some suspicions, rather strong suspicions in my country, and not in country, in country too, but in within the Politburo, that he might be to do something. I remember Andropov once told me directly, you could expect everything from Reagan. So be careful and watch very carefully about him.
Who was the Soviet president that was best and worst to deal with?
But there was very few of them, really, because it was in that time, it was Khrushchev, then there was Brezhnev, there was Andropov, and there was Chernenko, and then it was Gorbachev. Well, I may put it, if you like, very briefly. Khrushchev, he was very emotional fellow. He really couldn't control his emotions, as sometimes he doing. In general, he opened, in a way, a door to negotiation with the United States, but it was a very jumpy road in dealing with them. And Brezhnev, he was more relaxed, so to speak, but he was a man who worked together with the other Politburo, because Khrushchev sometimes overruled Politburo and make his own decision, emotional decision. So it was rather a mixture, combination of collective leadership and his own. With Brezhnev, it was always collective leadership. He never went against the majority of Politburo. And, well, Chernenko was nothing really. It was completely zero in our policy history. Andropov was a good one. He probably the most knowledgeable president we have. Not president, he was the Secretary General. But he died rather soon.
Let me ask you what might strike you as an unusual question.
Go ahead.
Okay. I know when I was a girl growing up, I used to have nuclear war nightmares all the time, right? And there were nuclear war horror movies and nuclear war political movies, and the whole country was obsessed with nuclear bombs.
Yeah.
Did you ever have nuclear war nightmares?
Me?
Yes.
Well, not at all.
Never?
Never. Well, you see, if you compare to nations during that period you're just referring to, exactly, you gave already explanation. In your country, you have a mass media, movies and press, etc. When you created on a certain period of your history, a really mass madness about the nuclear things. In my country, we don't have this. We were not that influenced by mass media about the horrors of the nuclear war as you. That's why you have much more nightmares than we have it, because we were not influenced to the extent you were influenced during that time.
Anatoly Dobrynin was the Soviet ambassador to the U.S. during the Cold War. The name Khrushchev once signified American fears about the Soviet Union. After all, it was Nikita Khrushchev who was the Soviet premier during the Cuban Missile Crisis. It was Khrushchev who vowed to bury us. But his son, Sergei Khrushchev, became a U.S. citizen in 1999. That year, I spoke with Sergei Khrushchev about growing up in the Soviet Union during the nuclear scare.
Do you think your father believed there would ever be a nuclear war? Even during the Cuban Missile Crisis, did he think that it might come to war?
Each politician have calculated all possibilities, including nuclear war. But he did everything to prevent this war, and think it is one of his biggest achievements that during his reign, these 10 years from 53 to 64, he, working together with President Eisenhower and President Kennedy, turned the world from war to peace. Because in 53 we were very close to the war, and then even through all these crises we just went not to the war, but from the war toward the peace. Or as he called, peace coexistence.
What was it like when you were the son of the premier of the Soviet Union? How did that change your life? Were there any privileges that came along with that status or responsibilities?
It's very similar in every way. It's no difference if you're living in Kremlin. Of course, we never lived physically in Kremlin, but to use this word, so you're living in White House or in the Windsor Palace in England, because you have privileges, of course, more than others, but we had not so many. We have no bodyguards, no limousines. We used subway when we went to the university, and the tram cars. But from other side, of course, you have to calculate everything because you're under the surveillance of the people. It was no freedom of media. It was no paparazzi in our country. They will not make, I don't know, your topless photographs and publish anywhere. But it will be rumors, everything the same as my parents told. All the time you have to remember that you are Khrushchev, have the name Khrushchev, and what you're doing, it will just be transformed in the rumors about your father and your family.
You know, in the United States, the image of your father, Nikita Khrushchev, was as someone who was very loud, very unpredictable, something of a peasant. And I'm wondering if that angered you, if you knew what the American image of him was and how you felt about it.
Really, I think what I'm working on, trying to present the real image, because if you are on the opposite side and you are feeling that people are your enemies, you are trying to make this image useful for you as bad as possible. And sometimes it's misunderstanding between the different cultures. And sometimes my father exploited this image, threatening the opposite side. You know, he used them. We think he's unpredictable, he can do everything, and he many times used it in his speeches and his sometimes negotiation, even in his interview. Because I remember when he gave the first TV interview, he was very nervous because before it was on the paper, so you present him questions and then he give you answers. And he can change everything what he want. And with you on the screen, you cannot change. And when they prepared the next room to his office in Kremlin, and he just walked in his office, his assistant told me who was there. And then he made his decision. He opened door to this room where was the American crew, and he began to shout, you know, you're Americans all the time, you're trying to find the worst things, you're asking such bad questions, and all others, and they were so surprised, sit looking at him, and then he did this performance about 5 minutes, then he stopped and turned back, went to the door and closed the door, and then they were so scared that they didn't ask any question that he didn't like. So he knew his about this image, and he tried to use it for his favor.
In the United States, people who grew up in the 1950s and 1960s had these nuclear bomb drills where in school we were taught to hide under our desk in case of a nuclear bomb. There were fallout shelters all over. Was there an equivalent in the Soviet Union? Were children being trained in what to do if there was a nuclear attack?
Yes, it was very similar. We were trained in school, also in each governmental office. You must to have the shelters. It may be half of money spent on these shelters than the buildings. But, you know, the nature of the people are different, as I told. All the time you lived protected by the two oceans. You have never enemies. And our people, through the different wars in this century, two world wars and the civil war and several small wars, so it was not so much serious of all these drills. But I remember after all these drills at school when they told us about the nuclear explosion, as you have to cover something with the white. And it was just the joke that you have to cover yourself by the white blanket and then slowly move in the direction to the cemetery. And they asked, why slowly? Because you mustn't create panic.
Oh.
Sergei Khrushchev, son of former Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev, recorded in 1999. Coming up, a review of the new movie about the Cuban Missile Crisis, 13 Days. This is Fresh Air. Just one more thing about the Cuban Missile Crisis before we review 13 Days. Political crises sometimes affect popular culture in surprising ways. For example, composer Steve Reich was thinking about the Cuban Missile Crisis when he was creating one of his formative works, his 1965 piece, It's Gonna Rain. Here's an excerpt of our 1999 interview.
This is a tape manipulation piece. What principle were you working with in this piece?
Well, I guess the bottom line principle was that sometimes when people speak, they almost sing. And there's no better example of that than a black Pentecostal preacher who's really, it's impossible to say if they're singing or speaking. It's hovering between the two of them. And this was a young man who called himself Brother Walter, who was in the Union Square Park of San Francisco in 64, or late 64, when I recorded him. And he's talking or laying it down about the flood in the Bible, and Noah and the Ark. And you got to remember that the Cuban Missile Crisis was in 62, and a lot of us were thinking that, you know, this was something hanging over everyone's head, especially in San Francisco at that particular period in the early 60s, that kind of thinking was rampant, that we could be so much radioactive dust in the next day or two. So this seemed very appropriate for the time in history when I was living, And I was playing with tape loops on a technical level. The tape loops are little bits of tape that are spliced together back then so that they just go around and around and around and repeat themselves. And when you take a bit of speech like, it's gonna rain, the way he says it, you really begin to hear the music of what he's saying and what he says increasingly blended together, so it's hard to separate them. And then there are actually two loops of his voice going, starting in unison, and then one slowly creeps ahead of the other. And then gradually you begin to hear it as a rounder can. And that's exactly what happens in this piece.
Well, let's hear it. This is Steve Reich's It's Gonna Rain, originally recorded in 1965.
He began to warn the people. He said, after all, it's gonna rain after all. For 40 days and for 40 nights. And the people didn't believe him. And they began to laugh at him. And they began to mock him. And they began to say, it ain't gonna rain. It's gonna rain, 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 it's gonna rain,
Steve Reich's 1965 composition, It's Gonna Rain. The Cuban Missile Crisis is getting played out in movie theaters. 13 Days stars Kevin Costner as President Kennedy's political aide, Kenny O'Donnell. Costner is also one of the film's producers. Henry Sheehan has a review.
Throughout 13 Days, director Roger Donaldson returns again and again to shots of the movie's three main protagonists, President John F. Kennedy, his brother, Attorney General Robert Kennedy, and his longtime political advisor, Kenny O'Donnell. Whether the three are gathered in the Oval Office or huddled together on a White House porch, their intense discussions are marked by glances that each of the men shoot off into an unseen distance. They are clearly under siege, and given the way the scenes are shot, we are under siege with them. What lurks in that unseen distance, of course, is the Cuban Missile Crisis, the nuclear-armed confrontation that began in October 1962 when a high-flying U-2 spy plane took pictures of Russian missiles being set up on Cuban soil. But 13 Days comes up with another foe for the Kennedys and their loyal friend O'Donnell, a cabal of their very own cabinet secretaries, military chiefs, and security aides. This group, made up of historical figures such as Dean Acheson, Generals Maxwell Taylor and Curtis LeMay, and National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, want the Kennedys to respond to the Cuban crisis with force, whether or not that leads to all-out nuclear war. The Kennedys, on their part, want to find another solution, short of catastrophe, but far from appeasement.
I can tell you, right now, I don't see any way around hitting them.
If we hit them, kill a lot of Russians, they'll move against Berlin. All right, they attack Berlin, that's NATO, and we're at war.
Well, damned if we do, but if we don't, we're in a war for sure somewhere else in 6 months.
Well, if there are alternatives that make sense, and I'm not saying that there are, then we need them, and we need them fast.
All right, what about Congress? Now, I think we may need to start letting key people know, and they're all scattered across the country for the campaign.
We can get Congress back.
Or we're going to need to get the UN stopping and warmed up. What about the allies?
We can't start worrying about everything right now. We got to figure out what we're going to do before we worry about how we're going to do it.
The choice, obviously, was the now famous blockade, a show of force that immediately stopped the flow of missiles into the island and demonstrated U.S. resolve. Some White House veterans of the crisis have levied criticism against the movie for elevating the role of O'Donnell, who is the movie's central focus when, in fact, he was peripheral to the crisis. That may be true, but O'Donnell is a handy figure for an audience partly because he wasn't in the middle of things. He was a sharp observer keeping an eye out for his boss's political interests. And in explaining those interests to Kennedy, he simultaneously explains them to the audience. O'Donnell is played by Kevin Costner, which naturally gives his figure a heft that other characters, played by lesser-known actors, don't have. Bruce Greenwood plays JFK and Stephen Culp brother Bobby with efficient and appealing impressionism, though they disappear within the pop culture contours of their characters. The same can be said of Dylan Baker's Robert McNamara, Kevin Conway's Curtis LeMay, or just about anyone else in the movie. Only Costner supersedes his character, playing not so much a Boston-bred political strategist, so much as a familiar Costner type, the ordinary family man called upon to serve in extraordinary circumstances. The movie's other historical distortion has garnered less comment. By limiting itself to the 13 days when the Kennedy administration formulated and carried out its blockade plan, the movie oversimplifies the situation. Castro, for example, is barely mentioned, and Cuba itself is dealt with as a mere launching pad rather than as an ongoing Kennedy sore point. Costner's presence and the movie's episodic limitation of events brings us back to those recurring shots of the two Kennedys and Costner huddled together. They look, for all the world, like two Earp brothers in Doc Holliday, as depicted in many movies, including one starring Costner. They don't make Westerns much anymore, but you can't kill a genre so linked to the country's idea of itself. 13 Days duplicates the action of a Western in the way it automatically identifies with its three heroes, in its constrictions of time and space, and with a narrative structure that depicts both a big enemy without and deadly rivals within. And it's a pretty good Western. The acting is uniformly solid, and Donaldson and screenwriter David Self have done a good job of integrating military action scenes with the desktop confrontations. 13 Days is so entertaining, in fact, that you might not even notice how it slips so easily into national myth-making.
Henry Sheehan is film critic for the Orange County Register. Coming up, Milo Miles remembers the founder of the Czech band, the Plastic People of the Universe, Milan Hlavsa. He died last week. This is Fresh Air. Milan Hlavsa helped change the course of Czechoslovakian history with his band The Plastic People of the Universe. He died January 5th of cancer. He was 49. Václav Havel was a longtime friend and supporter who credited Hlavsa and his group with keeping dissident culture alive under communist rule. Music critic Milo Miles has this appreciation.
In many ways, the rock and roll of the Plastic People of the Universe was very peculiar. It was music where Frank Zappa and the Velvet Underground loomed as big or bigger than the Beatles. The sun didn't shine very much in Plastic People songs. The jokes were sardonic. The dreams were small and savored quickly. It was Franz Kafka meets Bugs Bunny. Yet there was nothing passive or escapist about the music bassist and composer Milan Hlavsa and his companions made. They were ferocious in the shadows. Hlavsa formed the group just a month after the Russian invasion crushed the independent spirit of Czechoslovakia in August 1968. But he always insisted the Plastic People were simply free expression purists. They wrote only one song with overt political content. They never intended to be dissidents or spend most of their existence as an illegal band, playing word-of-mouth gigs in barns while the secret police hid in the woods outside. Harassment from officials was constant after the Plastic People lost their state license in 1970, but the big bust came in March 1976. Some 27 people were arrested, and two members of the band were sentenced to jail terms, artistic director Ivan Girouche and saxophonist Radoslav Brabenets. This crackdown inspired the formation of a formal human rights movement called Charter 77. Future Czechoslovakian president Václav Havel was a key member. The Weary Band split up in 1988, and for several years, Hlavsa led the group Pool Knots, a harsher, harder-rocking outfit with a female singer that echoed his old fascination with the original Velvet Underground. Pool Knots recorded one album for Arista. It's out of print. And indeed, Plastic People albums have always been very hard to find in this country. Two of the best, if you come across them, are the debut, Egon Bondi's Happy Hearts Club Band, B-A-N-N-E-D, and their knockout reunion release, 1997. All the music played here is from that album. The band did a short tour of the U.S. after they got back together. When I saw them perform in 1999, they were clearly charter members of the worldwide community of anarchist hippies, a bunch who would stand apart anywhere they were. The determined bass lines, freeform sax, dissonant folk fiddle, and gnashing guitar blended into the sound of liberated spirits who demanded respect but expected nothing. They were dangerous because their authoritarian state said they were. They were dissidents because free expression is always a political act. Now the Plastic People of the universe are gone forever, but they leave in triumph.
Milan Hlavsa died last Friday in Prague. Music critic Milo Miles lives in Cambridge. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Random House Incorporated's Dell Paperbacks Division, publisher of The Complete Book of Food Counts, 5th edition by Corinne T. Netzer, with updated listings. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we listen to excerpts of Martin Luther King's civil rights speeches. Our guest will be historian Claiborne Carson, co-editor of a new collection of King's speeches. Also, we meet R&B singer and guitarist Barbara Lynn, who had the 1962 hit You'll Lose a Good Thing. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.